Okay, today is the 26th of January, and it's Bridget Brownlow here interviewing Dr. Michael Larson. And thank you very much for coming
welcome.
Here.
Glad to be here.
Maybe we'll start if you can give me your full name and date of birth and place of birth.
Okay, Michael Joseph Larson, January 31st, 1944.
Your birthday's coming up.
And my birthday's coming up. Good. New York City.
New York City, great. And if we could start with just a quick overview of your educational background.
High school, or do you want college?
Sure.
Want to start at college?
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
So high school, I went to St. Dominic's High in Long Island, and through that connection, I learned about St. Mary's, so I came here in 1961 and stayed for an arts degree. Graduating in 66, and after that I did a two-year master's at Dalhousie in English, and then got funding to do a PhD in English at University of Toronto.
Okay. So you were off to U of T in 1968?
68, right.
Yeah, okay.
So I was there from 68 to 70.
Okay.
And then taught in New York high school for a year. And we were here, Jeannie and I were here visiting her mother when I got a job offer, a temporary 9-month sessional to teach English at St. Mary's.
Wow.
So we just did that for pretty well just expecting the 9-month sessional would be it. But that was in 1971. So.
71. And you're still here.
I'm retiring this year, but yeah,
that's great.
That's 40 years ago.
Wow.
So.
Okay. In 1971. So then you started the 9-month sessional in 1971.
Right. So Owen Kerrigan was
president.
Was starting his presidency. My contract was probably one of the first ones he signed.
Was it really?
Yeah, I think so.
So your contract was signed by the first lay president at St.
Well, I wonder, because Edmund Morris was...
Right, of course, that's right.
...was acting president
that's
for a while,
right.
I think in the late 60s.
I'm going to come back. I'm glad you reminded me of that, because I'm going to ask you some question about Edmund. Okay, maybe we can go back to 1961. Can you describe for me sort of your arrival at St. Mary's and what it was like and what it felt like? And
well, I can tell you, having... arriving at the airport, looking down and wondering where the city was,
right.
because I hadn't traveled that much, but I had flown into Boston and New York, and so the idea that I had was, of course, that the airport was, you would see lots of buildings.
Sure, that's right.
Some high rises and this and that. And I kept looking around, wondering,
couldn't see anything.
Oh, right, where are they hiding? Didn't realize it would be, quite a trek in. But on the bus ride in, there were three or four other guys who were heading the St. Mary's. Because I had come from New York to Boston, Halifax.
Okay.
So there were a bunch of guys that got on in Boston who were heading here, and we met when they dropped us off at the old Nova Scotian hotel. And we took a cab up to St. Mary's. Came right up English Street.
Wow.
And I can tell you, one of the first things you noticed then was the side of the building hadn't been finished, so the stonework hadn't been completed.
Of McNally. Right, okay.
So McNally was the only building. So
right.
They had these steel rods extending out from the side of the building that would be used to hold on the granite siding when they finished it, but they were, I guess, waiting for the money to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
But these steel rods had, of course, rusted, and the rust ran down the concrete slab sides. And looking out, I wondered, where in the heck am I?
That's right. That's right. Where have I been to?
But then we came around the front of the building, and of course, it was much more attractive.
Right.
And I thought, this looks much much nicer. But I tell you that when you looked at it from the side, and the first The first guy that met us was the president of student council, who was from Quebec and had a very thick French accent.
Hmm.
The next guy I met was from Newfoundland, and he had a very thick Newfoundland accent. And then I met a kid from Trinidad.
So very international, really.
I thought, I'm going to be between languages here, because I had a pretty thick New York accent thing,
yes.
too. So, anyway, it was quite an introduction.
Oh, yes.
To the place.
And so what would have been the student population then, if you can generally?
About 500.
About 500 students.
About a couple hundred in the residence, and then the others were what we call day hops, I guess.
Day hops. I've heard that before. Okay.
The local students, and they had a lounge in the there was only the McNally building, mm-hmm. so there was a lounge there that actually not far from where the theater auditorium is, and that's where the resident students would meet a lot of the local,
okay,
you know, kids to sort of
in this lounge
in the lounge, yeah.
Right? Okay.
So you got to know some of these students that way.
And who was the president again at the time that you would have arrived?
Father Fisher.
Right, Father Fisher, right.
And he was the president throughout my, you know, my undergraduate years. Yeah.
And what was he like?
He was a man who you didn't see much of,
okay.
except at, you know, formal occasions. He was a very taciturn, dignified, very competent administrator, as I understand. And as I say, he was somebody who was in the background.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't attend many of the sporting events that I recall, but he had a kind of presence. You know, mm-hmm. when he showed up, you kind of knew something major was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he was, no doubt, he was a very competent man, mm-hmm. and a competent president. But no, he didn't have much of a kind of presence among the students.
Okay.
Of course, the person who had all the presence among the students was Father Hennessy.
Right, right, of course, that's
he
a great...
He was the Dean of Men.
He was the Dean of... That was his title, eh? It was the Dean
of
Men?
That's mm. right.
And
we were the men, I guess.
That's right, yes. Okay. And what are some of your... I've heard different stories from different individuals within St. Mary's about their recollections of Father Hennessy, but wondering if there's any special ones that you wanted to share.
Father Hennessy was an incredibly attentive, caring individual in terms of the young men who were here. I think he certainly seemed to feel that they were a kind of personal responsibility of his, a responsibility that he enjoyed, but took with enormous seriousness. I think he felt responsible for our bodies, our minds, and our souls,
mm-hmm.
and he was just tireless in his efforts. And we were orangutans, by and large. But I can remember, and this happened to numerous people at numerous times. You'd be sneaking into the residence way after lights out, and if the doors were locked, there were windows. Remember I told you there were these iron
yes.
spikes? We used to climb up the iron spikes to get into the windows.
Clever.
You'd get in, and you'd think you'd be safe. You'd be creeping down the hall, and suddenly you'd see this glow of a cigarette off in the distance, and it was Hennessy, and he would say, "See me in my office at 6:30 or whatever, you know, some ungodly hour in the morning." I don't think he slept. And that long cigarette holder and the ash glowing at the end of it. I found them one time. I thought I had made it safely back, and made it into my room only to see the glow in my room. He was sitting in my bed waiting for me.
That's right.
I mean, it was hard to fool him. He just seemed to be awake and everywhere all the time, but he was enormously supportive at times when one got into trouble with various authorities. He was always there to intervene and make I won't get into details, yeah. but
I mean, make it okay.
Yeah. He was a wonderful guy.
He really left a wonderful legacy, didn't
oh,
he? That people
enormous.
I yes.
Mean, students loved him.
Yeah.
I can imagine the parents did too.
Yes, that's right.
Honestly, he did. And Father O'Donnell mm-hmm. had a not as intense. Mm-hmm. His support was more on the academic side, but if he found out, particularly if you had any interest in something, he would do whatever he could to help foster and develop it, whether it was languages or public speaking. He was very big at.
Right. Okay.
You know, and he had skills. He had this non-credit thing that I think we were all supposed to go to, and it was to develop public speaking skills.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd get all of the usually the freshmen.
Right. Yeah.
And. And we thought, you know, these were required,
right.
So everybody would go. But he would, you know, throw out these topics, and you'd be walking up to the, you know, to the podium, and he'd hand you a topic, which so you had like about four strides
to
sort out your thought process of what will I say about, you know, this topic. I remember the first one I had to do because it must have struck such terror into me. But I was walking up. See, you got to remember, I'm 17 years
yes.
old. I speak with a funny accent.
Yes.
I'm looking at all these. The topic was sleep. And you had about a 5-minute.
Oh my gracious!
Window. So you really did, after a while, learn how to tap dance verbally.
Right. Yes. To really think of
you know?
Very quickly and.
But yeah, he was a very good guy. Mm. I liked Father O'Donnell a lot. They used to call him Buck.
Buck.
I don't know
I've
if
heard
that.
Buck O'Donnell.
Buck O'Donnell.
Right.
You know where it came from?
No.
Do you know that story?
No. Love to know that.
In residence, we had to, when you woke up in the morning, you had to make your bed. And it has to be hospital corners and, you know, military kind
really?
Of
it was that strict?
Well, they were, I shouldn't say, but that was the expectation.
Okay.
You had to do it, and there was a bed check. Usually by the proctor,
okay,
and or you know O'Donnell, and if you didn't do it, it cost you a buck.
Oh.
And or if you were late, it cost you a buck.
So that would have been significant too. I mean,
well, that was serious
of,
money.
Yeah, that's right. I'm thinking trying to yeah, of course, a
you
buck
know,
would have been a lot.
A buck was a lot.
Buck O'Donnell.
If you were late for class and didn't have a good reason, that would cost you a buck.
Really? Well, good yeah. for him.
Yeah. So.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, they had their ways.
No, part of the reason why I was inquiring about the beds and whatnot is what I'm hearing in the oral histories in terms of a pattern is the significant shift that took place, you know, in the later 60s
mm-hmm.
in terms of student protest and a number of people have spoken of the American influence on our campus here.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe there's that you could speak
a little bit
to that. Yeah,
sure.
If you saw that coming or how that.
Yeah, I think to some extent the early 60s to understand sort of the mental culture of St. Mary's with the Jesuits and the mm-hmm. students. And the early 60s started out as, I would say, you know, a time of optimism, a sense of creativity. I mean, there was Vatican II was suggesting new roles for women.
Yes.
Reconciliation with other churches,
yes.
including Protestant denominations and so on. There was a reaching out. John the 23rd, you know, had this image of the sort of the genial father figure, all-encompassing sort of radiant soul, open and so on. Real sense of optimism that some major differences racially, gender,
mm-hmm.
sexuality, mm-hmm. various forms of sexuality could be reconciled. I'm, one of the big movers and shakers intellectually who was in the church at that time was Hans Küng, the German theologian, who is now still writing, but outside of the church.
Yes.
So there was a lot of that. I mean, and in that wave, I think a lot of some of the Jesuits were moving. I mean, they were pretty smart guys,
yes.
A lot of them. Some of them developed relationships with, you know, women, and some moved out and they got married. I think there was some thought of this becoming part of the, you know, a kind of a new Catholicism, a kind of more, say, tolerant and all embracing. And then, of course, there was, I think you have to see it to some extent, that part of it, and then some of the things subsequently, as a kind of reaction against that, is the more conservative elements got panicky about this, more than a little panicky. And some reactions set in because, like I say, some of the Jesuits were leaving, but I can remember how intellectually exciting that time was.
To you. And, in terms of intellectually exciting in general, or like in the classroom, or
Outside, inside.
Outside, okay.
I can give you an example.
Yeah.
One of the guys we knew really well, a student who was killed in a car accident, and a couple of the Jesuits got together and had a kind of ceremony for Jack, the kid who was killed, because he was basically an orphan, and he came from Newfoundland, and there wasn't any family, and they put together this thing. It was very intimate for those of us who knew him, but it was very moving. I mean, it was and I don't think Jack was particularly a religious guy in any way, but the way they talked about him and his importance and his relationship to others and so on, he was just, I mean, I can tell you, this happened in the early 60s, and I still remember it.
Yes, yes.
You know, so, you know, so there was that kind of thing going on. And then one of the things that always struck me, I graduated in 66, and one of the ironies of life is that the Vanier, who was governor general, was brought to here, and he gave the commencement address. And, I mean, he's this major figure, this saintly ultra-conservative Catholic, and, you know, this iconic figure, the Vanier cop, his name did.
Yes, our residence.
Vanier, yeah. And one of the great ironies of life is that I got the Governor General's medal that
did
year.
Did you really?
So this American gets to be Vanier. But he was quite an elderly man, and his wife was alive then, too, and but I think, in a sense, they were brought, in retrospect, I think, because they were such important, iconic figures, but I think they also represented a kind of older vision of the role of the church and the very doctrinal, very doctrinaire, very, very pious and accepting of these eternal truths that that conservatives feel, you know, have already been written down in indelible ink forever. And I think to some extent that represented an attempt to sort of bring St. Mary's more toward its back to a more conservative root tradition, so on. Because I think even in the years when I was gone, at either Adele or in Toronto or in New York, you know, the sense I had was that during those transition years, there was a real desire among the board members and some of the other movers and shakers at the time to see St. Mary's change in some ways, I guess, to move toward a co-ed kind of thing. But I think there was a real desire to hold on to certain things that they perceived as core values, despite the fact that the university was going public, it was going co-educational, and so on. And I think that probably made those years, late 60s, early 70s, with the influx of so many new faculty,
yes,
with so many different ideas and so many different viewpoints, and,
yeah,
and such a sense of the importance of academic freedom to be able to,
right,
to explore and to publish and to speak your mind,
yes,
and the truth as you've discovered it, and
yes,
it was setting up a time for real conflict, which is, I think, why the early 70s were pretty volatile.
Right.
You know, there was that's my take on it anyway, that those early, I don't think you'd understand that without seeing what happened in the early and mid 60s,
yes,
the sort of liberalization that was going on, and
yes,
I think there was a reaction against that, just as this whole new dimension was about to occur.
Right.
The university going public.
Yes.
It going fully co-educational.
Yes.
And the introduction of all kinds of lay faculty from all kinds of disciplines,
mm-hmm,
and various parts of the globe. And that was a pretty, pretty heavy time. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, and then the attempt, I think, was by the board to get someone young and, dynamic, and as a president, bring in Owen Kerrigan, guy from, St. Avex, and strong, six kids, good Catholic, very, very clear in his own mind about certain things. That set up an interesting dynamic.
Yes,
I
yes.
Think when I remember some of those early faculty members who had very different ideas about what could go, could and should go on in the classroom, the kind of material that could be taught, the kind of approaches to it, and so on.
Someone mentioned to me earlier that they saw Edmund Morris as a very logical conduit in terms of, after LaBelle is gone, you've got Edmund, mm-hmm, Morris, again, good Catholic man,
yeah,
easy to sort of pass the,
yeah,
the torch on to him. And so I think that's a bit what you're saying with Kerrigan, that he,
yeah,
he demonstrated these values.
And he was younger than Edmund, and he also had a PhD, and he had,
right,
published at least one book and maybe more.
Right.
So I think, there were certain expectations that perhaps board members had.
Right.
But then, you had this, it was a very volatile time, people were staking out new areas of intellectual,
yes,
territory, the new approaches to teaching. One of the most interesting, it probably seems ridiculous in retrospect, but, and you've probably never even heard of this machine called the Gestetner machine.
No.
But
how do you spell that?
I can't tell you.
Gestetner?
A Gestetner machine. But it was basically, it had this, it was a way of reproducing. You would type up something on a paper that had a backing with a certain kind of ink, and then you would use that to, it would turn around a turntable type of thing, or a cylinder type of thing, and each page that would go under the cylinder would reproduce the typing that was on the page.
Ah.
So you could make copies of a variety of things for your class. The interesting thing about that was you weren't tied to a textbook totally.
Right.
So I can remember people going into English class and, we might have a textbook, but this is when I was teaching. But they may bring supplemental poems that I can remember one colleague of mine, a faculty member, was teaching, Philip Larkin, a great poet laureate, now dead, from England. And one of his poems was about, was a meditation called Church Going, and it's about basically the demise of faith and it's on. And when it got out to some members of the board that this was being taught in class, I mean, that was the subject of a board meeting.
And this is in like 72.
This would have been in the 70s, yes. Yeah, in the early 70s.
Right. Oh, that really helps put things in perspective.
Yeah. Right. So there was that, you know, who are these people? These people who are teaching, and what are they teaching? And
right.
You know, has this been cleared in some way? Is this, you know, we are, you know, a Catholic university. We have these values, and you know, and so the, you know, people who were left leaning politically, or
yes.
You know, had pretty what at that time was perceived to be a radical, you know, sort of social agenda, or
yes.
They had ideas that weren't, you know, suited to the predominant, but you know, orthodoxy in terms of, say, sexual relations or any. I mean, well, that caused a bit of a strain.
I can imagine now. Yeah. You know, that's a fabulous insight, because just reading the documentation, say the journals and the times, and from that period of time, one particularly around the secularization of the university, there's very little said. So the impression one gets, unless you're engaged in an oral history interview, is that it all just was done and finished, and there was no subsequent holding on.
I think, well, from my perspective,
yeah.
There was a real holding on.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. And as I said, one of the things that freed up people was something as simple as the Gestetner.
Right.
You weren't always, you know, here's an article that you made, here's a poem, here's a short story, here's a, you know, this is, you know, here's my own thoughts on something.
Right.
But, yeah, there was... there's one Larkin poem where he's contemplating this. It's in the 60s, and he's looking at this young man and his girlfriend, and he says in the poem, "I guess he's fucking her,
mm-hmm.
and she's fucking him."
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting. It's a oh my God! Let me tell you, when that got out, this was. I mean,
no, it was just radical, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah.
And so then there would have been.
I mean, you know how the reaction to Catcher in the Rye still.
Yes. Yes.
Because it has the F bomb.
Yes.
It, you know, and, well, you can imagine this is the early 70s, and and some people were not happy that, you know, and this was a. I can remember board debates. Now this was later on, but some alumni members of the board just getting absolute meltdowns because when the residences when there were condom machines.
Right. Yeah. That would be
huge, huge reaction. Yeah. No,
it's just these are all the small details that you don't think about, but that would have been very upsetting to board some board members.
And I, you know, even many years later, I can remember being involved in fundraising and being told by some people that, you know, as long as that goes on, you'll never get a nickel from me.
Right. And in my own experience here, somewhat off topic but related. The current battles on campus around pro-life and pro-choice, I know that there have been as well funders of the university who have said on either side, same thing, you'll never see another cent if this continues or doesn't continue, whichever side they happen to be on.
Yeah.
But some certainly still linked even today with the, you know, the Catholic teachings on that.
Yeah.
Wow, this is fascinating. So, can I jump back to your time up to 66? I understand from reading your previous oral history that there were two women that you've identified as the first, really the first official female students.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about
that? Well, actually, full time, I guess, because there have been women here In the education program and through continuing it
in the
for
evenings.
For a long time, yeah.
Right, okay.
But the big change was when I'm not sure. I think it was Eileen O'Leary who first approached the university about coming here to do a program that wasn't available at the Mount in political science. And Eileen, who I knew before and knew pretty well, was a very smart student. She was at the Mount. And there were few people who had the intensity of interest in political life as she did.
Okay.
In fact, she's, you know, she's been in politics all her life.
She's a senator?
I don't think she's a senator now, but unless she's in Ontario. But she's she is a member for what's her riding up
her constituency
there.
What's that? Her constituency.
Yeah,
yeah.
Her riding is in
okay.
Oshawa.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, she's been a long time MP.
Does she still go by O'Leary?
Eileen Carroll.
Right. Okay.
CA, yeah.
Right, I knew there were two names. Okay.
Yeah. She'd be very interesting to talk to.
Yes.
Her son, Daniel, went here.
Did he?
Yeah,
okay.
He graduated.
Okay.
Okay. Kevin Carroll is her husband, and he graduated from here. You know Plymouth dealer?
Yes, Carroll's Chrysler, yeah?
Carroll, yeah.
Yeah.
That's his brother.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So,
but so she came, and then Jocelyn Grasby.
So with Eileen, so she went and sought, to your knowledge, went and sought permission from the president at the time? Or?
Yeah, and I think the archbishop had to sign off on it
okay.
as well.
So Hayes and Fisher would have had to sign off on her.
That's
one
my
would presume.
Understanding.
Okay. And would they, I mean, what would be your guess for an all-male institution? Why would they have... Why did they let her in?
Well, I think she made a strong case that it was a program-related issue. St. Mary's was teaching women. I mean, it's not like women hadn't had any role here. There were some in continuing education. I think it was also the... to be honest, I don't think it's hard... I don't think we should forget about the impact of John the 23rd, really, and the whole that whole era of
yes.
opening up and reaching out. And, there was a fair amount of momentum to break out of the old paradigms.
The nuns are changing their habits.
Yeah, sure. There
yeah.
were new roles being envisaged for women, some people resisted, but some people were quite sympathetic to it.
Right, right.
And from my sense as a student here then, there was just no problem. There was quite a bit of support. Probably there was some who thought it was not a good idea, but I don't remember anybody. I mean, most of it, say in residence, a
mm-hmm.
lot of us were from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And we were used to co-ed,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Catholic schools, you know, regular schools. So it wasn't a big deal. And didn't expect that there was going to be any huge problem with that. Some people trotted out, well, what about the washrooms?
Oh, right.
Just...
Figure those things out.
Yeah, you put a sign over
yeah.
there. this is not going to be a huge issue. You know?
So was there much...
And Jocelyn...
Go back to Jocelyn, yes.
Jocelyn, she was an extremely nice... person, very bright. She was, I believe her interest was engineering, but she also was very, very bright. She was brilliant in literature.
Mm.
And so, and within 10 minutes of talking to either one of these people, you were just interested in them as people, and then,
sure.
I don't think the students, at least I never heard of any students having any problems.
would they have, to your recollection, would have drawn any attention to themselves, or they just sort of showed up and went to class?
They showed up, went to class. Yeah.
And no one
did presentations in class, and you know, went to the lounges to chat and have coffee, and just sort of did integrated into. I mean, Eileen was very active in political societies because she was just fascinated by political life. And was exceptionally good at it.
Okay. So, so there's those two, and they're here during your time in 61 to 66. Do you remember much discussion by the year 66 about co-education? I mean,
no.
It wasn't on the radar then.
I think if insofar as it was, our expectation as a student would be that this will, you know, this will evolve and happen, and why not?
Okay.
So because, you know, I mean, I don't think it in 66 we were aware that, no, we weren't, that things were going to quickly move into the public domain.
That's right.
You know.
Because by 67, there's
yeah.
lots of documentation
yeah.
that it was a huge topic, you know, both in the journals and,
yeah.
but that doesn't happen from my research until 67.
Yeah.
yeah. Interesting. Okay, but as a student body, you just expected that you'd be moving in that direction
yeah.
anyway. And
yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
And I don't recall many, none of the guys I knew were particularly interested in seeing it remain only a...
They weren't, eh?
No. And maybe some of us took our cue from Father Hennessy, who felt quite happy with some of these developments.
Was he? Was he?
Yeah,
do you know that he...
I mean, there's certainly, if he didn't, he certainly kept it well hidden.
Okay. I mean, there's going to be a few people I'm going to talk to who didn't like the idea of women coming to campus, but the majority, as you said, from what I've read as well, have absolutely supported it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
See,
okay.
I went to a Catholic high school, and there were women. I mean, it just was not an issue. You know, we were just used to it and didn't see what the problem was.
Okay.
There was, I mean, there must have been some question, I mean, certainly it was out there for a long time, what about the relationship to Mount St. Vincent? And, you know, what could happen there, given that they were both Catholic institutions? My understanding was that the presidents, in the latter years, like when Father LaBelle was president, Sister
Catherine Wallace,
yeah. both very brilliant people, very
yeah.
strong-willed, but on different radar. I think they had, and Father LaBelle, brilliant as he was pretty eccentric guy. And,
was he? I've wondered if his personality.
I think he left the Jesuits for a while toward the end and had a relationship with some woman. And I understand he was killed in a car accident.
Was he?
Yeah, in the latter 60s and so on.
Really?
Yeah, so there was, that's what I think and sort of recollect.
I did an interview last week with someone within the university who he started here in 68, and he said that his recollection was that at that time there was so much criticism coming from the student body that the Jesuits wouldn't have been used to
mm-hmm.
About various things, whether it would be co-education or whatnot, and that LaBelle didn't handle that well.
Yeah.
And
I'm not surprised. He was
really disturbed by it. And
well, I think he might have been going through his own sort of personal crisis.
Sure.
You
yeah.
know, as well.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of Jesuits in 68, 69, I mean, not a lot, but there was a number who did leave, who got married, who just did, you know, went on to other things. And I think part of that was the sort of all the buildup and expectations that many were felt positive about in the early 60s, and then the reaction that set in and the sort of closing down of those I think put a lot of strain on some of the Jesuits.
Can you help me understand a bit better what you mean by that, closing down of these, so the heightened expectations and then things didn't really happen the way they thought they were going to, or?
Well, I think in terms of intellectually
and
you know, the way the church would evolve, its loosening of certain doctrinal positions, the ordination of women, for example, marriage.
Right.
Some of those guys were not made for the celibate life.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of them saw that as a possibility within the church, and then it disappeared.
Right. You know? Still isn't happening. Right. Yeah. Oh,
anyway,
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so they felt, you know, that.
I've
heard of numerous ones who left, actually. So from that period of time.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, no, sort of back to the Mount has featured quite prominently in my research because of failed, a series of failed negotiations, as you pointed out. With, and in fact, the Sisters of Charity at one point had purchased land here and then ended up, you know, the deal was squashed. And but that was interesting to me, too, to see that there was a lot of panic at the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
About the coeducational step here.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah, I can imagine. You know, it might be interesting to talk to, although we came on later, was Ken Osmond.
Right.
But, of course, he knew some of the players at the presidential level.
Yes.
So he may be able to throw some light, you know, mm-hmm. interesting light on some of that.
Okay. Now, I've spoken to women who were among the first larger group of co-eds that arrived, and they said that it was as if they were still really on an all-male campus, though it could have been because the numbers were so low, I guess. So by the time you came back to teach here, what was it like then? You know, how many women would have been around? And
yeah, it was not a huge number. It would have been, you know, predominantly, it would have been probably about 80% male.
Okay.
And so I can see just by sheer numbers, that might have been a problem. It was also, you know, the early 70s, there was a kind of let it all hang out male thing, the young guys teaching, who probably were pretty edgy. And thought this was really going over well with the guys, which it probably was, but it may have been pretty offensive to some of the women, too. I mean, who didn't really appreciate some of the edginess of these young hotshot PhDs, or soon-to-be-minted PhDs.
Yes.
Who were young, full of vim and vigor, and as I said, there was a kind of iconoclastic dimension to. It was the emergence of a real protest era.
I mean, that's sort of
reaction to Vietnam, and that spilled over for many years in the 70s.
I've heard Canadians describe that they really noticed the American influence. And
yeah, and here. Canada had its own reasons for being sort of anti-establishment and sort of harder edged and cynical and skeptical and, in the early 70s, I mean, and the run-up to the oil crisis and inflation and, plus the sheer numbers of people being hired, you know, so you take all these people who had no common history and no connection here and throw them all in this mix, and sometimes it was, you know, volatile as hell. You get people at fist fights and department meetings and, you know.
I could have had a lot of work back then.
Had a lot of work back then. I mean, because we were growing pretty quickly, too,
That's right. Painful things come with that.
You know, and from people from all over and varying viewpoints, and plus that, like I said, the culture was a kind of edgy and and antagonistic and, you know, skeptical and somewhat cynical. And,
very exciting time, though, to hear you describe it.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But of course, the you know, the aftermath of the Vietnam War certainly had a lot. I mean, it's Richard Nixon. I mean, I mean, you got to remember Richard Nixon.
There's a lot in the student newspaper, you know, in the journal about happenings with Vietnam, with Nixon, with, you know, that features prominently in almost every issue during those years.
Yeah. You ever talked to George Narabecki? Because he was a student during those years when Owen Carrigan first came, for example.
Was his father also a professor?
His father was.
Okay. Because I've been confused when I've gone through with that. Well, which Narabecki is that?
Okay. So George, he'd be worth talking to, particularly for those years. He was, I mentioned that journal article that featured Owen Carrigan today to you. Mm-hmm. One of the early articles in the journal about Owen, maybe it was the first one when he first came here. I think George wrote it, but the picture had Owen coming out the front door of McNally, and he was opening his shirt, and you see the Superman thing, and he was just about looking like he was going to fly off to whatever. And yeah, I think, and it kind of depends on how you interpret that, I think. I think for some of the older board members and others out in the community, they saw Owen as someone who was going to be Superman to take the university back to traditional values and so on. I don't think that was a role that Owen saw in himself. I think one of the things he wanted to do was to see the university grow. He wanted to hire a lot of new faculty. He wanted to pressure the faculty who were here to get their doctorates finished.
Yes.
You know, he had a lot, and he was young. He was like 36, 37.
Wow. Big job.
He had it was an enormously. But, there was lots of conflicting expectations placed on him. It must have been very interesting for him. Are you going to talk to Owen?
I am.
Yeah,
he's
a fascinating guy. I like Owen.
I've never actually met him, I don't
think. Oh, really?
No. But I would love to talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd be very interesting to talk to. With the relationship between the board and then the new faculty coming in and their expectations, and he's, like I say, one of the things that he was concerned with was to ensure that if you came here with a doctorate almost done, you finished that, or you moved on.
Right.
Because he wanted the university, on Owen's side, I think, he wanted to enhance the reputation of this university,
right,
which, vis-a-vis Dal, vis-a-vis some of the others,
mm-hmm.
was the jock school, it was, whatever, and I think he wanted to really move it quite a bit to the next level. And so there were those, and then there were, as I say, some people on the board who wanted an older kind of 50s institution.
Yes.
I think he was trying to negotiate among a whole bunch of different expectations and, in a sense, to help the university grow and professionalize it.
Would you see any link between that and him possibly, carrying on the mandate of the Jesuits in trying to enhance the academic reputation of St. Mary's? So if you look sort of back at the Irish Christian Brothers, mm-hmm. and come to Jesuits and tidy things up. And
yeah, absolutely.
Would you
say, concerned about the academic reputation. Interesting, along with that, though, Owen loved sports.
Oh.
He's a basketball player himself. He would probably, I would say, he probably seldom missed a basketball, a football, a soccer, hockey. I mean, he supported student activities completely.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife did as well. She came to huge numbers of games.
Wow. So that side of the university was also something that he was very involved in. And
very involved with students.
Yeah.
Very involved with their well-being and their activities. You know, not only in class but their extracurricular activities. He put in lots of time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had six kids himself. So,
wow. Yeah.
You know.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of material. This is wonderful. Is there anything else that, I mean, I can always touch base with you later if you should think of something else, or is there anything else that you can think of that might be relevant to, especially to those two areas, to the, you know, introduction of women, the official big introduction of women and secularization?
The secularization was, from my perspective, was far more of a strain on the older world here. The older board members, to give you an idea, when this, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the early 60s, I bet one of the biggest supporters were the women involved in various churches around town who had teas to raise money for the university, to buy the silver tea service that they would use. I mean, the ladies' auxiliaries were really an interesting, important part of helping support this institution in the 50s and early 60s and probably in the 40s and maybe, you know, God knows how long far back. But they were connected through the churches and they felt an intimate connection with the university and the people here, the Jesuits and so on. I think when this university was moving toward a secular identity, that was a strain on a lot of those older people, long-term connection. And when the university, by law, really had to adapt to certain types of things, like you couldn't enforce certain rules simply because they happen to be the rules of the Catholic Church, for example. Catholic schools had women in them for a long time. I don't think that was as
big of a deal.
Big of a deal. I think that personally, I think that was an easy transition. But I do think moving away from that world, I guess you'd say. The warm embrace of that old orthodoxy into the much more contested, open, freewheeling, windy world of modernity.
It was
a tougher go for.
That's a really fabulous insight. I'm very grateful that you shared that, because one would never, garner that from looking at the student perspective at the time.
Yeah.
You wouldn't really necessarily even think about the students, based on what I've read, and they were just keen to get the girls here and other types of changes. But there's nothing really about how difficult a struggle that would have been behind the scenes for those who had supported the university and its Catholic tradition for so long. That's really interesting.
In small and large ways, as I say, it wasn't uncommon for these various ladies groups and churches to have church socials to fundraise for this or that. The story, no doubt, about Norman Stanbury, who when they were finishing the McNally, they ran out of money.
I think they ran out of money, right? Yeah.
He opened a line of credit for the rest of it.
Wow.
Personal line of credit to enable it to be completed. I mean, that's
incredible commitment.
That's how much it meant to the people who supported it, and what they must have seen happening quite quickly was it being co-opted into.
Fast forward to condom machines on the campus and all.
Yeah,
the
and
what was it all for?
Well,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
That's fascinating.
Mm. You know, are we simply becoming drowsy?
Right. Right.
Nothing is to, I'm just saying,
no,
you know,
that's
another.
Right. Yeah. Just another university.
You know, whether, you know, it has this tradition, but it's now something new. And that was a tough go for some people.
Even when I look at.
It was absolutely necessary, by the way.
Yes,
I'm not saying it.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I say, it was a challenge.
Even when I look at my own time here, it's only been recently that the Archbishop is no longer.
Yeah.
You know.
Chair of the board.
Chair of the board. And
yeah.
What else have I seen change? Our first non-Jesuit chaplain
mm-hmm.
has arrived this year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting how. You know, there would be some who say that we still clung too long to some of the values. But
well, you don't find, I don't think, board meetings being dealing with issues about who's teaching what in the classroom, which we used to get, you know,
right.
in the early 70s. And,
right.
you know, real comments about this or that article in the student newspaper and, we, you know, the notion that we have to stop that. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, just that kind of approach is, you know, is gone. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
it's very much a public institution, and you exist within the rules of, you know, of law and the sort of guidelines that everybody else does in society. But otherwise, this is a world of free inquiry and
yes.
Freedom of speech and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
Isn't that amazing that you've seen all of this happen throughout your time
well,
here?
Well, particularly those early years.
Yes.
Quite a.
You look far too young, by the way, to have been here in 1961.
You're an adult.
You do, though. When I read your earlier history, I went, no, he wasn't here in 61.
Yeah.
That's way too early. Yeah, but what you've seen, the shifts are just, it's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful transformation. I really, everybody connected with St. Mary's has a lot to be proud of.
Yes.
Well,
there's
even
a wonderful
even the older
here.
Reactionary types,
yeah.
I mean, they were holding on to it. But I mean, they over the piece, a lot of people have contributed enormously to this.
Yeah. And a real, you know, I've also been fascinated by individuals that I've interviewed from the 60s who were non-Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a bit surprised at that because I hadn't thought there would have been very many.
Mm-hmm.
And how connected they were to Hennessy and,
yeah.
you know, how they would participate in all kinds of different, you know, Catholic traditions. And,
yeah.
you know, I'm sure that wasn't the norm, but that did exist. And
yeah.
Did you know of the term that they called the Mount Hungry Hill?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I just learned that. I thought that was hilarious.
Hungry Hill.
Hungry Hill.
That was not nice.
I don't know why I heard that. Okay, I think, well, you've given me a fabulous amount of insight and detail. And, oh, yeah, no, just fabulous. And really, you've set me now on a whole different course by some of the things that you've raised and behind-the-scenes things like you talked about with the board and traditions and whatnot that I hadn't thought of before. So that will be very rich and
I'm
very
glad.
Grateful. Yeah, so thank you very much.
You're
and
welcome,
I'll conclude it and I'll get you a copy of the